Good morning. He took my opening line. I mean, it's really nice to begin about how lousy Medicaid is, and it's really only a part of the whole. We get it. We stipulate that. Let me just say that Medicaid is very much at a very important time in 2014. Already, Medicaid is a bigger program than Medicare by about 7 million members. That's going to change significantly, depending on what states do, come 2014. So I think we're really, in many respects, at a sea change time in the Medicaid program. And it's important to remember that states have to do two things. The first thing they have to do is really fundamentally redesign and modernize their Medicaid program. So regardless of the choices that states make to expand or not to expand their Medicaid program, the ACA requires some fundamental reforms in the program. Simplified eligibility, simplified, streamlined eligibility that connects with the marketplaces, that connects with the exchange. So it really, for the first time, finalizes at least the delinking of welfare and Medicaid. It's clearly a health program for low-income people, integrated better with the commercial sector through the exchanges, and expected to really work seamlessly with them. So again, the Medicaid, the newly eligible for Medicaid have a different eligibility standard and can have a different benefit, more like the commercial. In many ways, though, the extant Medicaid population, the disabled, the elderly, remains in the old system, the old eligibility processes and the old mechanisms. So in many ways, if you will, there's almost now a Part A and a Part B Medicaid. Part A being low-income health insurance for low-income people. Part B being the extant Medicaid program with its long-term care with long-term care and disability and elderly kind of responsibilities. So that's what states must do. States may expand coverage. So will they? What are the choices that states have to make about whether or not to, and this is, of course, a huge political debate in states. For many, we wonder why it's such a big debate. It's a moral imperative. Today, we have the opportunity here to cover everybody to 138% of the poverty level, and once and for all, end health care by zip code. Today, you get health care if you're poor, depending on the zip code you live in and what choices states have made. You get health care if you're uninsured and poor, through the cost shift to uncompensated care. And when you live in a rural place like me, you can't open the newspaper without seeing the ultimate immoral activity every day, which is bake sales and church suppers to help people who are uninsured pay for health care. So how can states not take on the moral imperative to pick up these dollars, particularly given that the federal government, through the ACA, will provide 100% financing for this program for 3 years, up to 90% going forward. That's a very good deal for states, a very good deal for states. And within the states, there's significant provider pressure. Hospitals, of course, will begin to lose their disproportionate share funding as more and more covered lives come through the hospital doors. As they lose that money, they're going to want to replace it with covered lives, and that means Medicaid, even though it pays lower than commercial rates, at least it's a dollar for an uninsured person. And finally, and I think this is an important equity issue, because, of course, the law never envisioned that Medicaid expansion would be a choice, people below poverty are not eligible for premium tax credits in exchange. So if the state does not expand Medicaid, the poorest of the poor, people between 100% and 400% of poverty, qualify for premium tax credits. The poorest of the poor, under 100%, do not. So they are effectively uninsured if states choose not to go forward. So why won't states expand? I now live in such a state. We have a Tea Party governor. It's painful to watch the things you built be slowly eroded. We have a Tea Party governor who's adamantly opposed to the expansion of Medicaid. The politics are profound in the states. These are deep ideological fights about those who believe that the government should not be providing health care, the marketplace should rule, and that it's inappropriate to build expansion programs on a weak foundation, which they perceive Medicaid to be. Our governor and many others call it welfare and say that they will not expand welfare programs, although clearly the ACA delinks it from that. So they really, these are people who believe the Medicaid program is broken, who support the notion of a block grant, and who believe any effort to support the expansion or to support the ACA in any way is somehow complicitous. It's a slippery slope to make sure that the ACA will stay in place when they in fact want it to go away. There are legitimate concerns in states, however. 10% is still real money. In 2017, when states have to begin to cough up some money to pay for these new expansion populations, the reality is 10% is real money. And in states, in some states, it's very significant money. And the question is, if we had that kind of money, if we had those revenues, even just the 10%, would we want to expand Medicaid with it? Would we want to restore some of the cut benefits in Medicaid, the benefits that were cut during the recession? Or would we want to begin to invest more in education? So those are the kinds of trade-offs of states, as states think this through. They also have pretty profound doubts about the sustainability of federal money. I don't think there's a lot of evidence that suggests the states have ever run away from their commitment to Medicaid match, at least in my career, and I haven't seen it. But you see states like mine suggesting that the Recovery Act gave a short-term bump in federal participation in the Medicaid program. It was always understood to be a Recovery Act, recession-based, short-term bump. It went away. Some of the governors are arguing, aha, that's proof that the feds can't be relied upon, even though it was always intended to be short. And I think another legitimate concern is this isn't an administratively complex undertaking. The newly eligible, if you think of the Part A and Part B, have different rules than the current eligibles. And the reality is, if there are additional administrative costs for states, those are not paid 100% or 90-10, but at the regular administrative cost rate of 50-50. On this chart, you can see here, 51% of the uninsured are at or below Medicaid expansion levels, 138% of poverty. Here you see the zip code analogy. And clearly you see there's great variation among the states in where the uninsured are across the states. So where are we today? And this is a fast moving target. This chart was made 3 days ago. It's already wrong. It's fun to be in a state. Today, 28 states, thanks to West Virginia's governor, have suggested that they support the Medicaid expansion, 20 oppose it, and 3 remain ambivalent. So again, this is governor's perspective. So 28 governors are now in favor, 20 opposing.
But we're ambivalent too. You didn't include Utah. We're one of the white states.
Your governor? Talk to Diane Rowland.
Okay.
See how things change? Now, this is based just on executive activity, and as we know, governors don't work independently. They have legislatures to deal with, and you can see that just over half of the uninsured reside in states that are planning to move forward. But that means 41% of the uninsured are in states that won't, and largely in that southern swath that we saw in the charts. This one I don't even dare stick to because it's changing so quickly. But again, governors can't act alone. They have legislatures. And already we've seen in Michigan legislative efforts to block activity. In Florida, we've seen that discussion play out. In Maine, yesterday, the legislature enacted a bill to expand coverage, linked it to one of the governor's top priorities about Medicaid hospital payment. And while that was a major campaign plan of his, he intends to reject the bill because he does not want to expand welfare. And politics, we could spend the entire time talking about the politics of reform. But I think that political climate obviously plays a pretty significant role in legislative and executive decision making. Today, we have 14 states that have Democratic legislatures and Democratic governors. 24 states have all Republicans, Republican legislature, Republican governors. So the states increasingly look like the Congress, significant polarization. And 11 states are split. Importantly, when you look at the world, the Medicaid program is a shared responsibility between the state and federal governments. We have different perspectives. When those of us from the states saw the enactment of the ACA and the startup date, well, there were two lessons that we've learned. And when I was with the National Academy for State Health Policy, we convened state leaders. And we asked them who'd all done reform initiatives of one form or another. Are there lessons here? And they said yes, with a consensus. One, if you pass reform legislation, make sure it goes into effect soon. Give people a card soon, so you build a constituency and they know what you have. Second, do it fast, before the elections. So this next slide is the, what were they thinking slide? And that is, in 2014, the Congress is up for re-election, legislatures are up for re-election, and 38 states will elect new governors. So January 1st, 2014, the ACA goes into effect with Medicaid expansion, the exchanges, et cetera, et cetera. That November, these huge elections are underway. What do we think we might be talking about in that period of time? And of those governors who are up, 21 governors that support expansion, 17 oppose. And importantly, with legislatures, you see increasingly state governments like the Congress have been gerrymandered. There are often safe legislative seats. The worry here is not that you might, as a Republican, lose your seat to a Democrat, but that you'd be primaried by a Tea Party activist. So that's kind of the scenario we find ourselves in. With that happy picture, everything's easy, it's a simple decision for the states. We're going to flip back the blinds here and get three states to talk in a little bit more detail about what's going on there, and then we'll open it up for questions. Let me quickly introduce them in the order in which they'll speak. Dr. David Sunwald is professor of public health at the University of Utah School of Medicine. He has a distinguished career at the state and federal level. He ran the health department in Utah, ran HRSA for the federal government, was a staff for Senator Hatch. He'll be followed by Stephen Ray, who's the executive director of the Economy League of Greater Philadelphia, which is an organization of 70 private sector leaders convened to address, quote, the most pressing issues facing Philadelphia, so of course, Medicaid. He was previously the policy director of Pennsylvania's lieutenant governor. Finally, we'll hear from Greg Moody, who has the best title in state government. He works for Ohio Governor Kasich, where he's the director of the Office of Health Transformation. See, Stuart, we know it's more than Medicaid. He previously served on the staff of the U.S. House Budget Committee and with the Health Management Association. So let me turn it to them.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Trish. It's such fun for me to be here. I've been to some of these meetings in the past, and it's just great to be enriched by all these smart people and hear your presentations. I was going to say I saw a lot of old friends, and I mean that, literally. I've known for a long time. Anyway, it is fun. It's frustrating, though, because I would have thought with the brain power in this room, you would have figured things out by now. And it seems like many of our dilemmas or concerns are consistent and continue. Anyway, I'm glad to be here, and notice the color coding, red state, my title there. I understand Idaho is the only state redder than Utah, but I don't want you to think we're all uptight Republicans. I'm going to lose my tie. I'm not going to take it off, but I'm going to show you that we can relax. Now, Stuart actually asked me to focus on Medicaid. There's more to report on, and I'm not going to give you a long lecture on what Utah is doing with health reform. But they have been, in many respects, progressive and done some very worthy things. We have our own exchange, was the first, along with Massachusetts, the first states in the nation to have an exchange. And just recently, the governor cut a deal with the Secretary of HHS to continue our exchange for small businesses, but the individuals would go to the federal exchange. But anyhow, we're kind of on the map for having had a health insurance exchange, albeit it's not as robust as it was in plan. We're one of those SIM states that Heather talked about, those state innovation states, 16. We're working on payment reform. We're working on workforce issues. And by the way, without going into any detail, because it's been long an interest of mine, health workforce, I don't think we pay enough attention to that. With all the efforts to get people in medical homes and primary care and ACOs, who's going to be there to take care of them? For example, in my medical school, which I'm proud to be on the faculty of and went to, the dean bragged with great enthusiasm that 26% of our graduates this year went into primary care. Well, 9 were family practice and the rest were internal medicine and peds. And we all know that they tend to go on and specialize. So there's no bragging rights about such a relatively modest number going into primary care. And we are in for deep trouble, I think, and kind of seriously have to look at other providers and physicians to provide the services needed for these expanded coverage.